Good morning and good evening. My name is Rohit and I will be your host for today's Awakened Talk. Welcome and thank you for joining us. Awakened Talks is a space where we hold conversations with individuals whose inner journeys inspire us and whose work is transforming our world in large and small ways. It is an all-volunteer run offering of Service Space, a global platform founded on the simple principle that by changing ourselves, we change the world. Thank you for joining us. Today, the theme which we want to explore is business, creativity, and spirituality with Kiran Khalap. We will start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves in the present moment, and we'll take the proceedings forward after that. So just a minute of silence. Thank you. Thank you again. I will like to invite Drishti to start with a song offering. And before I do that, Drishti, little bit about Drishti. So Drishti is a third year student of MBBS and she's a volunteer with Service Space. And since the theme today is creativity and creation, I would also like to tell that she's a wonderful artist, or should I rather say artist in herself. And she was actually telling us a beautiful story a couple days ago, that how one day she was walking in the road to reach the metro and she saw a small she saw a street artist on the road who was looking a little bit desperate for money, who looked a little bit distraught, and she wanted to help, she wanted to connect with him, but she wanted to offer him some money, but she realized that she did not have any money. So she saw only thing which she had in her pocket was a metro card and her handmade doodle. So she went and actually gave that doodle to that artist, and he was really touched and he wanted to offer a painting in return. And Drishti says that I cannot take this painting from him because I wanted to offer him something, but what his act and his smile on the day made my day as well. So thank you, Drishti, for being an amazing heart of connecting and uniting, as Kiran would say, everywhere you go. And over to you for a song offering.
Thank you. Aakash ganga surya chandra tara sandhya usha neena nathi आकाश गंगा सूर्य चंद्र तारा संध्या उषा कोई ना थी नदी कोनी पुनि कोनि सागर धारा भेद केवल शब्द हमारा निकमारा आकाश गंगा सूर्य चंद्र तारा संध्या उषा कोई
Thank you, Drishti.
Thank you, Drishti, for that very moving prayer, reminding us of no boundaries. And that is the theme which we want to explore today, along with many other things. And I am very, very delighted to have a very special guest, Kiran Khalap, today on call with us. And it's very hard to do any justice to explain or try to tell a little bit about Kiran Khilap because of the multifaceted life experiences and journey which he has been through. But just to try a little, Kiran, since 1999, has been co-founder of brand consulting company, which has come to be very reputed now, called Chlorophyll. It is a model company in many ways in terms of leading with values, leading with no boundaries, and also in terms of redefining also professional competence. Before that, a very interesting thing about Kiran is that at 17, when most of us are busy actually thinking about our careers and our next fun trip and vacation, Kiran says that he is the most important thing for him was to understand what the truth is. And that truth, that quest for truth, led him to a very interesting and unique journey, which we will talk about a little more today. And yes, so he's a co-founder. He is one of the most respected branding professionals. He is a rock climber, which is something quite unique. He's an author of
three books. Very mediocre rock climber.
He's an author of three books. And he has, despite all these four jobs, he has another three jobs. He has another live job, which is dissolving the self. So thanks a lot, Kiran, for joining us today. We are extremely delighted and humbled to have you today. And I think I would just close by saying that despite all of this, what really stands out to us, to me, about Kiran is not his achievements, but the way, the humility which he holds all of this, the poise and the feeling of joy and friendship through which he holds all of this. And also his keen intention and willingness to be a student of life at every moment is thank something you, which inspires us all. Thank you, Kiran.
Thank you for inviting me. Yeah.
And so we have, and to just to brief people, everyone on the call flow, we will engage in a dialogue with Kiran for the next 50 minutes or so. I will interview. And then after that, we also have we'll take questions from all of you audience. So you can post any of your questions or comments or reflections for Kiran. And you can do that through email at ask@servicespace.org or through the chat form, which is there in the live stream page where you are viewing this conversation.
Which may or may not be answered satisfactorily.
Yes, sir. Thank you for that, bringing that spirit of not knowing and exploration to this, which is so refreshing. Thank you, Kiran. With that, I would straight like to, Kiran, jump into one of the questions which is personally right now most alive for me after reading and listening and hearing a bit about you, which is that you have a full-time job, which you call as your day job, but you say your life job is dissolving the self. And that is not something I have heard many CEOs or professionals speak, that your life job is to dissolve the self. So how do we get to even understand what does that mean? And to add, then, what are some key metrics through which you judge this idea of dissolving the self?
Yes, you can't consciously dissolve yourself. It's a very difficult thing. So what I say is that every human being's responsibility is conscious evolution, right? So evolution happens at its own pace. I don't know if you remember when Darwin mooted the idea. He came upon it because at that time geologists started talking about the glacial evolution, how glaciers move over eons. And that is how Darwin thought about, yes, so evolution happens over time. All our jaws, for instance, over the last, let's say, 1,000 years, the size of our jaws of human beings has grown smaller because we don't eat raw food. We don't chew as well as we used to do 1,000 years ago. And that's unconscious evolution happening over time. My belief for myself is that as a human being, the greatest responsibility I have is to have conscious evolution. So I must find ways and means of finding out what is the next level of consciousness. Now, if that leads to dissolving the self, so be it. But the starting point is, I'm not saying I'm going to sit every morning and dissolve myself, because it doesn't sound, it doesn't mean much. But yes, that the life job is conscious evolution. So it must be faster than organic evolution. That is the responsibility of a human being. That's the way I look at it.
Beautiful. Thank you. Amazing. And which brings me to the question about your early years, Kiran, that we have heard you say that in the beginning of, in the early years, in your teen years, you had a very strong quest for truth. And that led you to various unique expeditions. Can you please talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think if we want to go to the really early years, I was born in half a room. So there were two couples sharing a 500 square foot room. And my parents were on the side where there was a window. And there was light coming in from there. That's how I got my name Kiran. Right? Because there was light coming from there. So that is the really early years in one beautiful place called Khetwadi in Mumbai. This journey, as I said, I had a cousin working in the Mumbai University Library. So I used to take all the books from there, Upanishads and, Sartre and all of those things. And it was not making sense. I presume at 17, this is too heavy. I read Critique of Pure Reason by Immanuel Kant. I read it, I understood the English, but understood nothing, right? Until I read Jay Krishnamurti. There was this one book called Talks and Dialogues with Jay Krishnamurti, which I don't think it's available now. And suddenly it was like light going on inside my head. There was this, for the first time, there was this understanding that there is an awareness within us which is different from the constant flow of thought that we normally experience. So this entire notion of the monkey mind, that monkey mind can be watched, you can be aware of that. That single division, that single separation was the thing that changed everything. I was meant to become a doctor, like all middle class children are meant to be either doctors or engineers. Then I told my father that I have to repay this gentleman for what he's done to me. He's changed my life. And he believes that if you have to change society, you have to change education. And I believe that too. And therefore, I'm going to go and help his cause. So I wrote a letter to the address that was behind that book. This was published in the US. So it went all the way to the US because they were conscientious enough. They sent it back to Chennai headquarters. They wrote to me and asked me to go and meet Pupul Jaikar, who was the vice president. She was in Mumbai. I don't know if you know, she was Indira Gandhi's confidant person who started the handloom revolution in India. So she was kind enough. She said, Kiran, don't go now. Finish your graduation. God knows what life will bring. So finish your graduation and then go. So I ended up going after I finished my graduation 20. On the day that I finished my chemistry practicals, I got onto a train. I didn't even know where this place was. And I still remember my poor father and mother and sister standing on the railway platform saying, how long will you be gone? I said, I don't know. What will you teach? I don't know. How much are they going to pay you? I don't know. And all I knew, I had a friend whose father used to be in the railways. He told me that you catch this train, and if you get off at Mughalsarai, 1.5 days later, from there you'll get a rickshaw for 2 rupees and you'll reach Raja. So that's how I landed up trying to help J. Krishnamurti's idea of changing the world.
Wonderful. Thank you. And Kiran, so when you went to the school founded by J. Krishnamurti, how were those 4 years over there? How did you receive and process JK from reading the book first, reading him from a few books, and then seeing some of his principles in action? And also you had the opportunity to meet and spend time with JK personally also a few times. So how did you process this entire thing, the person as well as his quote unquote the teachings? What changes it brought about you in those 4 years?
It might sound strange, but I really wasn't interested in meeting him. Right? Because he himself had said that you read the book, I've shown you the path, and you have to walk. You have to walk through the door yourself, is what he used to say. I didn't have any sense that if I spend time with him, it will change me. My entire belief was I have to change myself. So I really didn't force myself to spend time with him. Because he used to walk fast, I was 21. So willy-nilly, I ended up walking with him because others may not be able to keep pace. Or there were times when we would have breakfast or lunch or dinner with him. But otherwise, I had no great a desire to spend time with him and therefore be blessed, or, you know, the word is receive grace. I really wasn't trying. So finally I was forced. One day they said, no, you have to sit with him. So I had a 15-minute meeting and he said, what do you want to know? And I said, actually, I don't have any questions. I was asked to come and sit with him. He said, okay, then let's just sit here touching hands. And we sat there touching hands. It was a beautiful, I still remember that moment, light coming in from my left, his right. This was in Rishi Valley. And then he said, sir, if you don't mind, I have a question for you. And I said, what is it? He said, will you be a teacher all your life? And I had to be frank and I said, sir, I really don't know. That was the end of that meeting. The place, one of the things that used to happen is quite a few people, youngsters used to come to the school in the hope that the environment would change them. And they would be really disappointed because, and most of them would leave after 6 months. In the first 2 weeks, I had processed it, as you say, as I didn't think place was any different from the rest of the world. The same thing that we hold, whether it is, yes, it was less competitive. It was far more relaxed because part of the philosophy of the schools is no exams till class 7 or 8. No competition. You do not celebrate winning as much as doing things well. So it was less competitive. But as human beings go, it was the same. There were people who would be getting angry or, you know, be nasty to others or gossiping. It was the same. There wasn't any difference. So in the first 2 weeks itself, I used to keep a diary then. And I wrote in that there is actually no difference between this place and the rest of the world. But that didn't bother me. I had not gone there to evaluate that place. I had 4 years of magic because I was bursting with energy, literally bursting with energy. I was in such peak physical form. I could in those days stand upside down on my fingers and do push-ups. That was the level of fitness I had. And whatever I knew, I taught the students. I had done calligraphy, so I taught them cursive handwriting. And there were, it is based in a fort. It's a Rajghat fort. So there are places there where there are little walls. So I took people rock climbing. I had done gymnastics. So I taught all the young girls gymnastics. I had learned judo. So I taught them judo. The school had two projectors, 16mm projectors. And I discovered that most of the embassies in Delhi give films free to schools. So it was like at least one film every 2 weeks. The children were having a ball. They had never seen watched so many films. Swimming, this side, remember that the campus is extraordinarily beautiful. It has two rivers. There is the Ganga, which is a kilometer wide. There is a Varuna, and the part of the Ganga which is next to the campus is dirty because that's where the sewage pipe flows in from the city. But the other side of the Ganga was clean, so I would take children swimming there. So it was 4 years of absolute magic. It was, I mean, everything that I knew, I shared.
Wow, amazing. And I hear you, and it makes me more curious, Kiran, that you're saying that it was not as much about the space, that the space itself will not guarantee any change or transformation right. in you. So I'm also curious that in these 4 years you spent there as a teacher, what is the one core thing which perhaps you learned about being a teacher? Because especially when we are concerned about values education, like everyone is trying to do this, but systemically we have seen that how most of the time schools are not being able to do a great job. Like, for example, there was another speaker, Venkat, who came on call a few days ago, and he said that as far as educating the intellect is concerned, educating the mind is concerned, I think schools are doing a good job, but educating for values or educating for heart, there's just very little competence in terms of schools. So what is one thing about a role of teacher which you could distill and give us for from your experience there?
Perhaps I didn't see myself in a role. I was just being myself. So I would say if you're looking at values, the biggest way to teach those values would be for you to practice them. Right. If you are saying being nasty or being disrespectful to children is not right, punishing them is not right. If you do it yourself, that is the biggest way to inculcate those values. When I look at the greatest influence in my life, it is my father. Right. In the 60s, my sister told me this about 2 years ago. 60s, he used to pay my mother an honorarium, a kind of a salary, saying this money is yours and only for you because you work so hard. Now, that is a value that is being practiced. As far as I'm concerned, that everybody is equal is something that I got from there. Very simple things. He would do very simple things, that education is empowerment. And the cost of us not getting new books, he would buy books for everybody in the family, the joint family, the connected family, or anybody who asked. Now, to me, it's the same. So education is empowerment. So anybody who's in touch with me, my driver, the ladies who work with us, the house help, all their children's education I pay for, because that's a value I've inherited. So it is, to me, the value is demonstrated rather than being talked about. There was one interesting thing, because Krishnamurti used to have these dialogues about what is fear and what is that. And when I landed up there, there was another gentleman who took me under his wing. Very fine gentleman, he's no more, Rajesh Talal. And he was very fond of having these discussions with the children, what is fear and all that. And I was uneasy with that. I said, this is all conceptual, right? It is, what are you discussing? What is fear? Let me show you what is fear. So I went to the Banaras Hindu University And I said, do you have a mountaineering club over here? And they said, yes. I said, do you mind coming to my campus? And the campus had these buildings with chimneys attached to them. These were all buildings built for engineers to stay when they were building the huge bridge across the river. It's one of the oldest bridges. I think it's at least 150 years old and still needs no maintenance. So I got them and I made the children rappel from that chimney. And in the middle of the rappelling, I said, now do you experience fear? You understand what it is. Try and see what it is. What is happening? Why are you so scared when you know that the rope is holding you? Right? So to me, that's another theme that that would be part of everything that I do. The living with concepts is like living a second-hand life. Right? Its concepts are not reality. So when you think about a concept like society, and I say, okay, you know, in Hindi films you say, ye mat karo, log kya kahenge. Now, my question is, who is this law? Can you show me? When somebody says society will be against it, who is the society? Can you show me? It will finally boil down to at most one chacha or mama or somebody who are going to make negative comments. It happened to me. So when I finally went to a residential school, on my mother's side, they had this notion that I have become a padri, because to them residential school means convent school, which means Christianity. So they asked my dad, do you think he's going to come home for Diwali? He said, why? I said, no, because Christians don't celebrate Diwali. He'll come home for Christmas. So that is society. That's it. Just one mama or one chacha, right? Otherwise society is a concept. So there is this constant thing about what the concept is. So if you are talking about values, then values are best demonstrated. Like my father demonstrated his respect for my mother, and therefore I would demonstrate respect for everybody. For instance, in chlorophyll, we write chlorophyll with a lowercase c. We never write it capital, because we say that we are different professionally. Of course, I'm not the same professional level as somebody who has just joined us, but as human beings, we are absolutely equal. Everybody's potential for whatever their life has to offer is exactly the same. The need to respect each other is exactly the same. The need for freedom is exactly the same. There is no office for the past 6 months. Nobody's been coming to the office. But otherwise, people would decide what time they would arrive and what time they would leave. So that's another theme that has been part of my life, which is growth through responsibility. So when you ask me what happened in those 4 years, is that was the important lesson that I learned, that growth is not, you don't have to outsource growth to your parents or to your company. Growth is your responsibility. You have to take greater responsibility, and greater actually responsibility that is disproportionate to your station might actually create faster growth. And even in my professional life, I've had the fortune of meeting so many people who did exactly that. So whether it was Alec Padamsi or Osha Bandarkar or Kirsty Kathar, these were legends. And all they did was give responsibility which was disproportionate to my experience, and that's how I grew.
Beautiful. So what I'm hearing is that practice the values first before you try to teach, and also try to deepen in the values through conscious evolution of yourself. And thanks for bringing chlorophyll, Kirana. We have been very amazed by reading some of the experiments and the values with which you have led chlorophyll till now. You mentioned about chlorophyll being spelled out in lowercase capital. Lowercase. Another thing which quite intrigued me was that one of the design principles you follow at Chlorophyll is, one of the organizing principles at Chlorophyll is not to attract attention to yourself, which seemed quite paradoxical given that it's a branding company. You've said that, for 10 years, you operated without any designations.
Yes.
And from the outside, we have glimpses of some many stories. So this is at all the experiments which you are doing at an internal design level and the employees level. On the clients level, we have heard stories that how you have always, like, in fact, it was one of the comments, I must tell our audience that one of the things which really stood out to me about Kiran's work at Chlorophyll is that it is a for-profit organization, but the kind of respect and community it has for all the employees. So it is perhaps the only company, for-profit company for sure, where I'm seeing that I have personally seen that there is a section, dedicated section to even talk about all the past employees who have been there. So that sense of family and community has just remained strong, and that continues to be there. Like, whoever we talked to, we spoke to Swati, and she was like, oh, Kiran is like family first and then everything else later. So it is amazing that there's a lot to learn, which we can learn from the way you have organized Chlorophyll. So can you talk a little bit more, Kiran, about that, what you're doing at the employees level, at the level of clients, how you're taking decisions, and how does all of that intermingle with ultimately the metric which starts constraining most of us in business as we engage in business, which is your net profit? Or so how all of that is panning out to you, just whatever.
Yes. So again, Rohit, I know it's, I don't know whether it sounds even sounds true for you, but I have never had a plan. I've never had a plan in my life. I have a plan. If I'm doing work, I have a plan that in the next 5 minutes, I have to do this research. In the next 10 minutes, I have to do this research and so on and so on. But I've never had a plan to say by so and so year, we will be so big. By so and so year, we would have expanded to 5 nations. And we never had a plan like that. Though I must admit that now I have a sense that we must do something to increase the profits, not because I need money, but I think we have grown to from 10 to 20, now we're 30, right? And I think I owe it to my community to invest in them. So there are some years when we were when we had enough to send one of my colleagues to Sydney to learn more, because that's the way I had gone to Sydney for 2 months to study film, and that's what I did for this youngster. Now I must be able to afford continuous education for them. So I must admit that now there is a greater shift to making sure that we remain independent. We are probably the last independent consultancy of our size in the country. Most of them now have become part of international chains. Now, I have this deep understanding that if I have to remain independent, then I must have enough money in the bank. This COVID has taught us something like that, right? You normally thought that if you had enough money in the bank to last for the next 6 months, it is enough. But now this is probably going to last for a year and a half. So there is a greater recognition that I need to pay greater attention to make enough profits to secure our future. But the way it is run is an extension of my beliefs, right? So if we are saying we are all equal as human beings, then why do you need to have a cabin? So we all sit in the same way, and the tables are the same. You won't know who's the CEO, who's the MD, because it's all the same level. There are no cabins in the office. Like I said, you decide when you want to come and when you want to leave. So the theme that I mentioned earlier, that this growth is through responsibility. So my attempt has to give greater and greater responsibility to the people in fluorophyll. That is how the Fluorophyll Innovation Lab started. So there is a youngster called Chitresh Sinha who hunted chlorophyll out. He was an engineer, but he wanted to be, he studied us for so long and he said, no, I have to work with her. And after having worked for 8-9 years, he said, Kiran, I want to do something on my own. I said, sure. It's so beautiful. That's exactly what I want. That from chlorophyll will come out many other mini chlorophylls. That would be a confirmation of growth through responsibility. Those are the themes that run. We used to have this question of, is it community or family? And I said, let's stick to community because families you normally don't leave. But I want you all to have the freedom, and if you want to leave, you can leave, right? So it's a community, yes. So we still have a WhatsApp community of ex-chlorophyll. And like everybody says that you can leave chlorophyll, but chlorophyll won't leave you. So I've had many, many touching. There is one girl called Jinisha. She was in Nepal or Sikkim or somewhere. And she had made a video for our birthday. Our birthday is on 15th August. And she sat in one tiny cubicle over there for 2 hours trying to send that video to us through the internet. So that's the spirit that is still there.
And Kiran, are there any stories which you feel called to share, which you can share with our community right now, that especially you value equality a lot, that all human beings are equal. So basically any story which you have observed where it is there's sort of a inherent tension or conflict between profits or like winning clients, which is something which we all have experienced in business. Yeah. Versus sticking to the values which matter to you most.
Yeah. So the values would come first, even if I'm making a loss. When I do my induction, one of the things I tell them is that to the value of being independent, and we have remained independent because we want self-respect. Self-respect is our first value. And we must be probably one of the few handful of consultancies that have sacked really, really big clients because they disrespected us. I don't want to name the names, but these are easily the biggest companies in India. So there are at least 4 of them that we have parted company with, saying, it's fine if that is the way you work, but this is not the way we work. You can't treat our people like this. You can't treat me like this. You can't treat my people like this. And there was complete clarity. There was no question that giving this up, we are going to lose revenue. That is fine. Then my responsibility is to find that revenue from elsewhere, right? We have not compromised on that.
Yeah, that is amazing. And even more amazing is what you're saying, that it was very clear. It was not like you had to think a lot, should I do, should I not do? It was very clear that the guidance was very clear.
It's the same internally. Even with employees, the only employees I have asked to leave, and I don't get angry or shout at them. I said, no, you cannot treat another employee like this. It's just not part of us. Right? So the only employees who have let go or asked to let go are people who are violent or disrespectful of others.
Beautiful. I just want to remind our listeners that they can submit their questions and reflections. I think we are already seeing a few questions coming in, interesting questions. So through ask@servicespace.org or through the comments section in the live stream page, and we'll continue, Kiran. So Kiran, now I want to get into this question of the work, the branding, I'm not a branding expert, sort of little bit of it seems that it is in the marketing side of things. And I want to ask this question that so you talk about branding, and the way I understand marketing is like, it is about building a perception. in about a product or a service or an idea. And on the other hand, to the extent I understand spirituality or dissolving the self, it is about removing all the layers of perception. So do you see that there is an inherent tension between the two? And how are you able to hold that tension together?
So Rohit, it was like that. It was about perception management till around 2005 in the rest of the world, in about 2011 in India. That's when social media happened. One of the outcomes of social media is that most companies are now naked. You can't hide. So you can fool people for a little while, and then the truth comes out. Hindustan Unilever for 15 years denied that they had caused mercury poisoning in Coimbatore. And 15 years later, they had to settle. They had to go for a settlement with them. So that is because of social media. That is because social media democratizes communication. Earlier, it was a one-way thing. The brand could speak to the consumer and the consumer would talk back. Now you have a separate thing called the online community or the peer group, where everybody is able to speak to everybody else. And therefore, you just can't hide. You take a company like Nike, like Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble in 2012 said that what we stand for, what the company stands for, not what their brand, not Crest or Pampers or Gillette. What the company stands for is they are proud sponsors of moms. Right? And they all the athletes, American athletes that went to the London Olympics in 2012, they took their moms with them, right, as a gesture of. Now, while all of this seems very nice, what on social media was happening is, yes, this might all be true, but you're not paying your employees in UK, the women get 34% less than the men. So how is this? How are both of these working together, right? So social media is forcing you to become more and more truthful, and the brand is unable to manage perception. The perception is closer and closer to the truth of the company because everybody is able to speak about everybody else. If you see a place called, a platform called Glassdoor.com, your own employees are going and posting about your company. How will you hide? How will you create perception when your own employees are talking about you? Right? If you look at PETA, Hindustan Lever used to test Lipton tea on animals. I don't know why it was done. They must have a good reason. To test it on rabbit size. PETA made them, through Facebook, created a huge campaign, and finally the chairman came onto Facebook and said, I'm stopping this, not just in India but in the rest of the world. So there is not too much of flex available to tell lies, to create perceptions when it is different from reality.
Thanks, Rin. That's very useful. And to build upon that, actually, the question which I want to ask is, I hear you that it is more difficult to lie in the age of social media. But I think what I'm more interested in is the idea of narratives. I think there's a very strong narrative out there that the more we consume, happier we are. And it's all like feeding us. You have said that, you yourself have said that the human mind is the most expensive real estate. And there are like hundreds and thousands of advertisements which we are being subjected to consciously or unconsciously on a daily basis, right? And it is also said that, you know, tech or any tools is an amplifier of human intent. But what is the overall narrative we are setting and what is the intent which is being amplified through this communication is a question worth asking. For example, you know, I love this quote by Reid Hoffman, who's the founder of LinkedIn. He said that all social media is designed to actually exploit and amplify the seven deadly sins. So what is the narrative which we are feeding on? In which narrative we are operating is the question I'm interested in asking you that. Yes, facts, right? It is more and more difficult to not do facts, not play your facts right. But what is the overall narrative? Which because that's also an intersubjective reality, as Yuval says, that it is all something which it is in our minds, that external resources. And we have seen that there's so many challenges with this external growth mindset and inequality which is creating.
So I wanted to start with the story. I'll tell the story now.
Yeah.
I think class 7 Hindi textbook, God created Earth and he created various species and then finally he created human beings. And then a month later or a year later, he called one of his assistants and said, listen, I've created this species called human beings. You go down and find out what percentage of them are happy. So that fellow went there, he did some quantitative and qualitative research and came back. Then God had called another assistant and said, listen, I've created this species called human beings. So go down and find out what percentage of them are unhappy. First one was going to find out. So this fellow went and did qualitative and quantitative research and came back. So the first guy came and said, Mr. God, sir, 90% are happy. And the other guy came back after research and said, Mr. God, sir, 90% are unhappy. So you will find what you're looking for. If you are looking for the negative effects of social media, you will find them. If you are looking for the positive effects of social media, you will find them too. Education. Education has been revolutionized by social media, right? People are teaching music, dance, English languages, Spanish through social media, through Skype. Skype is a channel, not as much as social media. So those are the positive effects of it. The negative effects are, you will believe that the elections are being doctored. So the I don't think there is one single narrative. Somebody is in charge and driving it. It is like atomic fission, whether you use it for your good or you use it to destroy Hiroshima and Nagasaki is left to us.
Yeah.
But as far as if you look at this earlier concept that the brand is creating a narrative which is asking you to consume more, that is no longer valid because people are making their own decisions and not listening to brands. Brands themselves are changing dramatically. I don't know if you know of this brand called Patagonia. Patagonia says reduce, reuse, recycle. And if you go to them 15 years later, they will recycle what you wear. Their famous ad is, don't buy this jacket. Because they're saying, you don't need it. You don't need a new jacket. Unless your old one is completely tattered, don't do that. A brand as big as Adidas is tying up with a competitor called Allbirds and is creating the world's lowest carbon footprint shoe. Because we are 7.5 billion, but we are using 24 billion shoes every year, which is all going into landfills or the ocean. We need to find a way of reducing. So there is a greater and greater consciousness that brands or companies are not outside society, that all of them are as responsible to the Earth's health as governments are and as citizens are.
Yeah. But at the same time, Kiran, one of the questions that's beautiful and is that all these brands, and I don't think it's perhaps not an individual brand is what I'm asking for, but collectively as we operate in interconnected systems, that, you know, as you're talking about conscious evolution, it is, and so you have a human being, a vulnerable human being on one side, and on the other side, you have organizations with a lot of organizing power, with a lot of big data, and I love it when, again, going back to Harari, he says that know thyself is something which all the saints have always told us, but this time today, it is becoming a very practical risk that unless you know yourself well, there are chances that people with a lot of systemic power, be it private or government, will know. It is very easy for them to know better. And Google has actually said it, that, you know, we know you better than your spouse. Perhaps we know you better than yourself. So it is very easy to exploit those vulnerabilities. So how do you see that playing out?
Yes, there will be segments of society which will be vulnerable. That is true. But again, at a universal level, whether that is true, I do not know. You and I may be more conscious of that and therefore can build barriers to being exploited. But yes, there will be segments of society which can get exploited. So again, I'm saying you can look for the negatives or you can look for the positives. Yeah. I have a presentation called Before Jio and After Jio. And if you look at After Jio, the empowerment of Bharat or India too is exhilarating. It is just unbelievable the kind of growth and the kind of empowerment that that digitalization has created for the poor in this country. So from being 120th in the consumption of data to being number one in the consumption of data, because data is so cheap. For every single brand that we work on, we do research, right? Primary research, not secondary, not desktop. So I was in this place called Bargad, which is Orissa. I was doing research on farming. And I stayed in this village with 200 people, 40 families. And everything that had changed their circumstances was related to what the mobile phone was doing for them. They had farmer WhatsApp groups which warned them about fake chemicals. They had farmer WhatsApp groups which taught them new methods like hydroponics. That is the positive side of it. Will the same medium, the same digital medium exploit that farmer? Yes, but it is also doing this positive thing for it. Education. So there is a view that India is revolutionized, Bharat or India too is revolutionized by the three V's, voice, vernacular, and video. So rather than type something and spend time, your Ola or Uber driver is able to speak to his phone. And mention that as that is the positive side.
Yeah. So, and one more question which came in from one of our volunteers, Kiran, is that as a expert in marketing and an expert in branding, how would you think about branding a good or a service, marketing a good or a service versus marketing innate timeless human values, say like compassion?
So we work for, I personally work for at least four different NGOs, right? I work for ARPAN, I work for Protsahan, I work for a differently abled group called Together, and we do work for the Sadhu Vaswani Mission, KK Institute. So some that is what Chlorophyll does, but I have worked pro bono for these organizations. So that is the marketing of good, right? How to create awareness for these unique organizations. That is one part of it. So can the skills that are involved in marketing be used for the good of society? Yes. That's the way I look at it. That is the way I'm helping these people to understand how to create greater awareness, because most of them are shy. They have this great passion to do something for. So Protsahan does this work for, uses art to heal abused adolescent girls, right? Now it uses photography, and they feel shy about talking about this because it looks like projection. It's what you are saying. It looks like you're creating this false narrative. And my answer to them is, but don't you want to help more of such girls? And the only way you can help such girls, if you tell your story, true story, to more people. So that, again, as I said, are you looking at the positive side of branding, or are you looking at the possibility that some brands may exploit some segments of society?
Beautiful. Talking about social work, I just wanted to also presence that Kiran has been doing a lot on the fringes also, which he does not, which he has not talked about. Like, for example, he and his wife together, his wife more so, but have worked a lot on restoring dignity and supporting the Indian native breed of dogs, which is pariah dogs. And also, interestingly, not many people you will come across who have actually a species of spider named after them. So it is Kiran and his wife both have a species of spiders named after them, which also is because they collaborated and used all their skills in terms of supporting nature, and which led to discovery of these species. So the person actually went ahead and to honor them, put it in their name. So thanks a lot, Kiran, for all the work which you're doing on the fringes, which does not even perhaps get as highlighted.
He also works for Tigers, for the Satpura Foundation.
Yeah.
She manages their social media. So they look after all the Central Indian Tiger Reserves, creating water, creating alternative employment. So that is also something that she does.
Amazing. And the other thing which is very, very dear to you, Kiran, is creativity. And you talk about this phrase, to create is to unite. That's a very interesting phrase. I've also been reflecting on it. And the question which I want to ask in that is, for me, the key word over there is unite. And I wanted to break down that concept a little bit and ask you that, what does uniting mean to you?
Bringing together. So here's how it happens. So if you look at the word creativity, it did not exist in ancient civilizations. All the beautiful temples, not all, there are some, there might be 2% of the temples, those beautiful temples in India, which are signed off by somebody has said that I created this. But the rest of all the statues and all the magnificent things that you see, there is nobody's signature over there. So there is a sense in which that creativity was seen as worship. The word creativity was discovered, was defined by as recently as 1927, right? And one of the problems with that word is that it is seen only for problem solution, for innovation, or for creating something new, right? While to me, that is the best definition, that to create means unite, because that allows you to think about it beyond just creating new art or new poetry. So what I keep saying is, creating, to create is to unite. This was given by a gentleman called Teilhard de Chardin, who was a paleontologist and a priest, and quite a few of 20th century philosophers have drawn from his ideas. So he, for instance, had this idea of, like we have atmosphere, we have ionosphere. He had this idea of a noosphere, of a skin of consciousness surrounding the earth. They're beautiful ideas. He had another idea called the omega point. So he is the one who came up with this idea of to create this stream, right? And that allows us to then look at creativity at multiple levels. So you can look at it at a physical level. So sperm meets egg and you have a baby. Your consciousness that you have as your own consciousness through meditation, that consciousness dissolves and unites with a larger consciousness that you might call samadhi or whatever. So at a spiritual level, you have a different connotation. That's why I like that definition. So rather than just problem solution, which is about innovation or creating poetry or creating painting, because if you restrict it to self-expression, which is what people do, then you can have a person who's creator and destroyer both. And I give the example that most people don't like, which is Picasso, that he gave us a new way of looking at reality. He said, in a photograph, I can see only one side of the face, but in a painting, why do I have to restrict it? I can explore the other side of the face, and he created cubism. But out of the 6 women in his life, 2 went mad and 2 committed suicide because of the way he looked at women and treated them. That is not uniting. That is destroying. So to me, then I would restrict his sense of creativity to a talent for doing something. And therefore, if you use to create this unite, you could have a person who's uniting people, who's uniting her consciousness with somebody with a larger consciousness without having talent. So the first book that I wrote, Halfway Up the Mountain means mediocre, is about a young girl who learns this art of uniting with a larger consciousness without having any talent of her own. So that the mistaking of talent for creativity ends when you use to create a student. So the specific, let's say when you want to define an idea, what does an idea do? An idea combines 2 frames of references to create a 3rd new frame of reference, right? That's an idea. So I'm in Mumbai and I come out of the railway station on a hot summer day and the guy is shouting, this is a real experience, Lal Baraf Khao, which means he's saying, eat red ice. Yes. So he has taken the idea of ice, which everybody has, which is cold, and he's taken the idea of red and combined it to create this unique idea in your mind because he's selling watermelon cubes. So he's selling watermelon cubes as red ice. And that's an idea.
Yeah.
So that's those 2 frames of reference coming together to create a 3rd one.
Thanks for beautifully expanding this frame of creativity, Kiran, to from self-expression to overall living.
Yeah.
And we also resonate that. I also resonate that it is one of the very critical things. We need a lot more creativity in the world today where the disconnection seems to be rising so much.
Correct.
Yeah. And we'll move on to some of the questions from audience now. And so there are quite many questions coming, Kiran, again, on your marrying of your values and your business, which is also your life job and also your day job. That I think the overarching question is that, do you see they feed into each other or at times they are conflict with each other? For example, Sonal from Bangalore is asking, have you ever been conflicted with, and I'm just quoting here, have you ever been conflicted between your external organizational goals and your inner values? How did you resolve those conflicts, and did it result in the compromise of your goals or it resulted in compromise of your values? Jayendra from Sydney is asking, can you give one example where you had a most difficult situation or problem in running your business and how did you handle it? Rohan is asking that how do you balance a culture of compassion with a culture of performance? So any thoughts on some of these questions? If you want to
take it on my mind. Like I said earlier, you're free to ask me questions, but I'm free not to answer. So one of the themes that I have got, I think probably from Krishnamurti, is that the word individual in itself means not divided. So you have this notion. One second. So that the word individual itself means not divided, right? And we have this notion probably in corporate, in the corporate world, that you have to perform in a particular way. So you have to be this snarling shark in the office, and you come home and you become this playful dolphin with your children. This is not possible. This is an artificial, arbitrary division. So this division cannot exist. So is compassion the opposite of performance? If performance is, by performance we mean an exploitative attitude to someone, then yes, it is the opposite of. There are times when people are undergoing great stress. Now, in this past 6 months, there have been people who have not been able to perform. There is absolutely no problem with that. Because what I tell the other senior people is, look at it. These people have been with us for 15 years, for 10 years. 6 months out of 10 years is nothing. It's not going to, our organization is not going to collapse. So it's fine if they don't perform at that point in time. That's the compassionate view. When somebody says that they are not, they are not doing this, they are not doing that, I said, you have a child. Are you impatient with the child when she's 6 months old that she can't walk? No. You know that it will take her 9 months to be able to sit and to walk. If it's a girl, she'll start walking earlier. If it's a boy, he'll start walking later. So you know that there is a journey, an evolution that a person has to go through before they are able to perform to the level that you want to. And you have to have that patience because you went through that journey. I know the errors that I have made in my life. And therefore, why wouldn't I grant that patience to somebody else? So that performance is fine if it means that the person has to rise to her greatest potential. How do I help that person do that? That is performance to me, which is how the Innovation Lab was born. Right? That person has risen to his highest potential. That is the, if you look at what performance that way, then there is no division. I'm actually being compassionate in helping somebody rise to their highest potential. What was the other question? Yes, as I said, there is no division between the what I am as a human being and the role that I play. So whether I am a husband, whether I am an employer, the values have to be the same. Whether even I'm a partner to an organization, it's the same value. So that I have to respect my client as much as I respect my employees, as much as I respect the courier boy who comes to the office, right? One of the things somebody wrote once, that she had come to our office and she realized that my office boy, we were celebrating a party, somebody's birthday, and our office boy gave a piece of cake to the courier boy who had come. And she said, that is the day I realized that the chlorophyll's values are right down to the last person. Because we are saying we have to treat everybody equally. What was the other question?
The other question was that any particular situation of a difficult situation in story of difficult situation in business due to these values that...
Like I said, the difficult situation is giving up very lucrative assignments because our self-respect was compromised.
Got it. Thank you. And there's a question which goes back to your childhood life, Kiran. So it is from Rahul. And he's asking that you shared in your teens you were reading the Upanishads. What led you to read such deeply spiritual stuff in your teens? What were the formative experiences of your childhood with your parents? And if I may just add on to the question a little bit, is if you can also talk about your relationships, that how it has impacted your own conscious evolution as you practice it. How has it impacted your relationships at work and your relationships at home and outside also?
There is a phrase I learned about 5 years ago called genetic lottery. I think So you can choose your friends, you can choose your boss, but you can choose your husband or wife, but you can't choose your parents. So I had a genetic lottery. My sister and I were very fortunate to have these two parents. They were not formally educated a lot. My father was class 7 in Marathi school, but and my mother maybe class 4. But they were phenomenal as human beings. So my father taught himself English. When I was conscious of him, he could read and write English flawlessly. He taught himself art. And when he finally got his job in Metalbox, he became one of India's most successful commercial artists. He also did a lot of work for Amar Chitrakatha. The boss asked him, okay, this is fantastic. Now, what you showed me just now, this airbrushing, nobody here can do that. So your job is on, just give me your certificate from art school and you're on. And he said, what certificate? I don't have a certificate. Because he hadn't studied in art school. So these are the parents. Now, he himself practiced this idea of conscious evolution. So he wanted to know what is the next step. And he tried to get what is called as grace or diksha from this gentleman called Kulavani Maharaj from Pune, who practiced Kundalini Yoga. And my father, not only my father, but my sister got onto that path. And those were the years on that, that is one path of, about spiritual evolution. The second was about reading. I read books, I think in when I was 5, for my birthday, he got 3 books. And the next day he went back to the bookseller and said, I'm sorry, but my son has got all these 3 books by heart. Can you give me another set of 3 books? So that fellow told him, your son will eat you out of home and hearth. Just let him join a library and be done with it. So this entire notion of reading a lot, that came from him. Therefore came writing. He used to write well, so I'm able to write well to some extent. Those are the formative years where our house was called the house of happiness. Many of my friends, when they were when they were unhappy in their houses, would come to our house and my mother would feed them. And my father would crack many jokes. He had an incredible sense of humor. So those were, that is roughly the formative years. So my sister and I always say that is the greatest gift we have got. We didn't have big flats or cars or anything, but we had such an incredibly happy childhood. So that has, I started doing Vipassana in 2003. And I used to be a fairly impatient child. I used to be fairly sentimental as a human being. And over time, as I have practiced Vipassana in a more and more disciplined manner, I have this idea that it has sharpened the working mind and slowed down the thinking mind. So there is one gentleman called Balsekar who had this nice little working definition of the thinking mind and the working mind. So the working mind is when a surgeon is doing surgery or when I'm doing some analysis. That's the working mind. There is no gap between concept and reality there. But when you're thinking about the thinking mind, when you're talking about relationships, that is when there is a gap between concept and reality, because we relate to each other through concepts. I think about Rohit as Rohit appeared to me during his talk. But by the time I meet Rohit day after tomorrow, Rohit has changed quite dramatically, right? So that relationship between concept and reality, that is another problem that gets solved when you are doing Vipassana meditation. I think there is very little gap between reality as you experience it and your extraction of it as a concept. You tend to not do the extraction as a concept and stay much more in reality. Very simply, because you start with breathing, right? Because you can't breathe for tomorrow. You can't breathe for yesterday. Breathing is here and now. So if the whole thing is to pay attention to your breathing, then you will be here and now. You will be, for the first time in your life, you will not be living in the past or living in the future. You will be living here and now. So that impacts relationships, because the thinking mind has slowed down. You are not creating any illusory thoughts. You are not judging people. You are not using the past to relate to them. That dramatically changes your relationships with people.
Beautiful. Thank you for bringing this, your personal practice of Vipassana upfront, out there. And so Vipassana has been a core practice, one of the core practices for you, Kiran. Apart from that, are there any other practices also which you follow, which I'm sure our listeners would love to know a little bit, that what are the other some practices which you follow for your personal evolution?
This third book that I wrote, Black River Run, is based on uses Ramdas Swami, who was one of the few saints who was physically fit. So I have always been physically active. My father was very worried that I would become a bookworm. So he pushed me into this outward journey. And I have been trekking since 1977. I had close to a 90 to 100 foot fall in 1979, from rock onto rock. But I have continued to climb. So one of the practices I do follow is a lot of yoga, Surya Namaskars, yoga, you know, Shirshasana, Sarvangasana, all of that stuff, a lot of core workout, because without that you can't climb well, and cardio, because you need to do that for climbing.
Yeah, one fun fact about Kiran actually is, as he engages in a lot of rock climbing, is that when he was in Calcutta working at, was it Linda? his office was in the first floor, and it was only rare that he would climb up the stairs. He would always go through the wall outside directly into the first floor. So that, just for ordinary people like us, it's just a very simple thing which he does for him, but like a huge testament for us to his fitness level.
Even in Banaras, I used to climb to the top of the terrace of the building. I used to take the children there, and we would sleep there instead of in the bedrooms, because you could sleep under the sky.
Wow. So, Kiran, second last question is that for someone youngster, and you engage a lot with youngsters, right? You, it has been in your DNA, you have held in the past also. So if there is a young person, say 20, just graduating from college, and he wants to spend a life similar to you, that have a good life outside, but also to explore that inner dimension, which is of understanding the self, and if perhaps dissolving the self, what is one advice? Even though I know you're not very much of an advice person, but what is one thing which one can take back from your learnings?
I really deeply believe that I don't see myself as an exemplar. I don't see myself as an example of anything. And that is not to say that, that is because I feel that everybody's path will be different, right? There is a notion of, if you study Ayurveda, there is a notion of Prakriti. Prakriti is your inherent nature, right? And then according to Ayurveda, that Prakriti is decided at the moment of your conception, and it will never change. So in Ayurveda, you have the five Pancha Mahabhut. So you have water and earth creating Kapha Prakriti, water and fire creating Pitta Prakriti, and air and space creating Vata Prakriti. Right? Similarly, in Western civilization, you have this psychosomatic constitution of cerebrotonic, viscerotonic, and somatotonic. Now, your Prakriti, if your Prakriti is different from mine, willy-nilly, your path will be different. That's why it is not possible to say let me be like him. You can't be like him or her because the influences that you have plus this inherent prakriti that you have are very different from anybody else. And the reason why I liked, I resonated with Krishnamurti was his famous speech was truth is a pathless land. There is no one way to approach it. And each one of us has very different tendencies, very different ways of how we remember things, how we approach life. And therefore the path can't be the same. This famous advice that follow your passion, 99% of people don't know what their passion is. Right? So what is the advice that you give? Now, there is no great advice besides saying, try and be as authentic as possible. Try not to lead a second-hand life. Try not to lead an unquestioned life. Right? So to me, questions are important. When you say, I'm so, and your parents have taught you, or your society, or whoever is around you has taught you, this is your caste. Question that. What is this caste? What does caste mean in the first place? Once you question that, then there is a lot of new discoveries and new ways that you'll find. One of the most disturbing things that I say to people is, you use this word I all the time, right? That's the maximum word that we use. If you don't mind, can you show me I? Can you touch I? Can you feel I? Can you smell it? No. So it's only an idea. It's not real. It's only an idea inside your head. And if you sit in one corner and you keep looking for that I, you'll realize it's only memories. It's very disturbing to people that the word we are so fond of is just a figment of imagination. There is no I. Now, if you do that kind of questioning, you will find your own path is the way I look at it. Rather than look at me or look at anybody else as an example.
Beautiful. And Kiran, you said that you love questions more than answers because questions can, you know, open up something within you. So I am very interested in, is there any question? What is one question which is most alive for you at the moment in your life? One question which, as a seeker, which is most alive for you at the moment?
No, I don't have it.
Okay.
I'm very happy as a person. I think I'm doing a process which is right for me, which is a combination of physical fitness and Vipassana. The foundation was laid by my father, then by Jai Krishnamurti. And the people that I meet, in fact, in Chlorophyll itself, there are at least 4 people who practice Vipassana. I didn't ask them to do it. It's just that they are attracted to this organization. There are at least 3 who practice chanting. So we have a set of people who's attracted to the organization because of the nature of the organization. I have no plans. I have no ambition. I have no great desire. I am happy if I have food once or twice a day. There is no need anything for any great riches. So I'm in a very, very, very nice and happy place.
That is remarkable, Kiran. Thanks a lot for sharing all this with us. It is just remarkable how in your early childhood you had that experience.
Do we have time for one final comment?
Yes. So there is one. Yes, surely. Please. There's a little bit more after that also, but please, one final comment.
So, if you find time, do watch this TED talk by this lady called Elizabeth Blackburn. She's a Nobel Prize winner. And she talks about something called telomeres. I don't know if you heard this word. Telomeres are the tails of our DNA. And out of these many trillion cells that our body comprises, every day cells are reproducing, right? They are renewing in the body. Now, every time the cell reproduces, this telomere, which is the tail of the DNA, grows shorter and shorter and shorter. Then at a particular point, when it has grown particularly short, it sends a signal to the DNA that it is time now to stop multiplying. That is the death of that cell. That is what then, that is how we get, wrinkles and hair grows gray and all of that. Now she's done this remarkable research about telomeres, and then she found this astonishing fact that if you meditate, if you are mindful, that process is slowed down. So there is a direct linkage between the process of aging and the process of stress. Stress causes telomeres to shorten. And if you do meditation, it actually slows that process down. So the sense of youngness, the sense of youthfulness, the sense of being happy is scientifically proven to be related to meditation. Even 12 minutes per day can make that difference. I thought it was a remarkable scientific discovery.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you. And before we move towards closing, Kiran, one final question is that how can service space as a group or as individual volunteers, they can support your intentions to towards all the good which you are doing in the world?
You already done it by providing me this platform. As E.M. Forster said, only connect. So I think it is critical for human beings to connect. It is critical for, like I told you the story about those who look for positives and those who look for negatives. If we build a sufficient enough connection between those who are thinking positive, doing positive work, I think that would be something that service space would achieve. Because as I said, I don't think everybody has to do exactly the same thing. Rohit's path might be different from Rahul's, different from Karan's, different from Anushree's. The paths might be different. But if you can connect and not have that division, that my ideology is better than your ideology, my path is better than your path. Let all paths coexist so long as we are planning, doing things which are positive.
Thanks, Kiran. That's a big takeaway for me from this talk, that let everyone traverse their own path.
Yeah.
And also the concept which you very beautifully explained, that there is no I. Where is it? Exploring where it is. And with that, I would like to invite Kinnari to actually offer a song which talks about the same concept of there is no I. Sorry, we'll be a little bit off time, but 3-4 minutes if you can all be with us. So Kinnari is a working person, but at the same time a mother of two.
Yes, we saw the
children. Yeah.
We saw Kinnari's daughter playing with the.
Yeah, and she's a volunteer as well. So over to you, Kinnari, for the song. After the song, we will spend a minute in silence and close the morning today.
I'm always envious of musical people because I'm tone deaf.
You are the inspiration for this song today. And this song actually, Kinnari says that this song came as a beautiful gift to their family during the lockdown as they were collectively practicing and chanting this prayer every day.
Wow.
Kinnari, over to you. Thank you for being here.
मनोबुद्धि हंकार चेतानि नाहं न च श्रोत जिह्वे न च घ्राण नेत्रे न च व्योम भूमिर्न तेजो न वायु चिदानंद रूप शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूप शिवोहं शिवोहं न मे द्वेष रागौ न मे लोभ मोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव म न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्द रूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्द रूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकार रूपो विभुर्वाच सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां सदा मे समत्वं न मुक्तेर्न बन्ध चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं
So, Kinnari, you should read my first book, Halfway Up the Mountain. It is based on this shloka. This is called, I think, Atma Shatakam by Shankaracharya. It's called the Song of the Soul. So, the legend is that he had gone to Banaras and he was going to stay with somebody and he knocked on the door and the person from inside said, Who are you? And he spontaneously said the shloka. That's the legend.
Wow.
Wonderful. Okay.
Atma Shataka. It's beautiful. So we used to sing this in Banaras. There was an assembly hall. Yeah. This assembly hall designed by Tagore's architect. And you can imagine 300 children chanting the shloka. It was absolutely otherworldly.
Beautiful. Thanks a lot.
On the banks of the Ganges.
Yeah. It is quite a mystery from where we go where. And in the same way, it is a mystery the way which we all came together in this particular formation. It is a pathless land, but for some moments, our paths unite. So in gratitude for that, we will spend a minute in silence. That may the goodness, if anything is there, continue to ripple out.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you all for joining today. And we look forward to see you again in a couple of weeks. And thanks to Kiran for his time joining us today here and sharing his remarkable experiences. And we hope that this is just the start and the conversation and the conscious evolution continues to build from here. Individually and collectively together. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Rao. Thank you, Sarasai.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.